Hey, Grant. So this week's episode is closing out the summer in a lot of ways, and it's also the final episode of our full second year of doing this together. So I want to say thank you and that it's been a good ride so far, and now we're turning three.
Yeah, well, thank you, Brooke. And I guess we're still toddlers in the world of podcasting, but I don't think we're quite throwing tantrums like we might in year three when we hit the terrible threes.
Yeah, we're definitely still toddlers, but I think we're doing pretty well. We have a few little meltdowns behind the scenes, but I'm very grateful that our producer, Jeremy, always smooths those out for us. I do love that we mark the end and a new beginning of Right Minded in this era of August, September, back to school, just because, you know, it's appropriate.
Although this year, you know, let's just call it a very weird back to school year.
Yeah, that is an understatement. How are your kids handling it?
You know, I think they yearn to walk in real hallways with their friends and get in trouble for chewing gum in class. And actually, that's one thing I've been thinking about with our new virtual learning. It doesn't account for the pranks and the hijinks and the class clowns that are part of school. And as disruptive as that might be, it's sometimes, you know, valuable time for kids to just laugh and have fun. What about James?
Yeah, it's just been a roller coaster for him. You know, one day totally fine and the next day not fine, or actually 1 hour totally fine and the next hour totally not fine. He went to bed the other night, the first week of school, saying all the things that I try not to say out loud, like this pandemic is so hard, it sucks. You know, I do say that in my mind almost every hour, but I was just nodding and saying, yeah, it is hard and it does suck, but it's particularly hard to hear when you feel like your kids are suffering and, you know, just to receive it and be like, yeah, I got nothing here.
No solutions.
And it is a pretty unprecedented parenting moment that we're all going through with this distance learning.
Yeah, I hear you, Brooke. And per my gum chewing and getting into trouble reference, I'm thinking as you say that maybe kids should be able to go on the playground once a week in some sort of configuration and just blow a bubble with some bubble gum and wave at each other. I don't have any solutions, but it's still back to school and there's still something about September that makes me want to buy a bunch of new books, which is what I used to do as a college student.
That's totally right. And that is also why we saved this interview that we recorded actually a couple of months ago with Courtney Mom for this week, because it's a decidedly back to school theme with all kinds of ideas and good advice from Courtney, who's the author of Before and After the Book Deal, because it's about being a better writer, being a better literary citizen, and kind of understanding the ins and the outs. And it made me think about back to school. It's a funny and very down to earth book. And as the subtitle says, it's finishing, publishing, promoting, and surviving your first book.
Yeah. So before we drop you right into our interview with Courtney, let me give you a few details about who she is. Courtney Mom is the author of the novels Costa Alegre, which is a Goop Book Club pick and one of Glamour Magazine's top books of the decade. I Am Having So Much Fun Here Without You, and Touch, which is a New York Times Editor's Choice and NPR Best Books of the Year selection. And the book that's the focus of this interview, Before and After the Book Deal, A Writer's Guide to Finishing, Publishing, Promoting, and Surviving Your First Book. Courtney's also the founder of the collaborative retreat program, The Cabins, and she has an amazing writing advice newsletter that I subscribe to called Get Published, Stay Published, which we recommend you sign up for at CourtneyMom.com.
That's right, Grant. And as you said, we are dropping listeners right in after a short break.
Brooke, I wanted to tell you about this little writing event that I'd like to tell people about because I think it might help them get inspired to do the heavy lifting on their writing projects. It's cool because it's produced hundreds of amazing books, including bestsellers, and thousands of people do it each year. And beyond realizing their creative dreams, many people just say it's a lot of fun. And it's free, which is cool.
It sounds like just the kind of event that many writers need, Grant. How can I find out more about it?
Well, you can go to nanowrimo.org. It's kind of a silly name, NaNoWriMo, which is an acronym for National Novel Writing Month, which happens every November. And the challenge is to write 50,000 words of a novel in a month. The idea is that a goal and a deadline as a creative midwife, and not to write your novel or memoir someday, but to do it today. Also, there's an amazing community of people who participate both online and in person. So it's like a rollicking party and a writing boot camp all in one.
And why the heck does it take place in November?
Because if you can write a novel during November, then you can write a novel anytime. Also, November is a dark and rainy month for many, so it's a good month to stay inside and write. And many people have leftover Halloween candy, which is known to fuel novel writing.
And you said memoirs can participate?
Yeah, a memoir is just a novel shelved in the nonfiction section by my definition. The main thing is to write, to banish your inner editor and focus on getting a first draft done because you can't edit a blank page.
That's amazing, Grant. I am going to sign up for this thing called NaNoWriMo.
It's not a newly discovered eel. It's not one of Jupiter's moons. It's not a mountain outside of Kathmandu. It's a novel writing event waiting for you at NaNoWriMo.org. Sign up now and start planning your novel. It was super fun to read. That was, I love the how funny you were about all topics. It was like a genuinely humorous book. And so happy to have this opportunity to talk with you about it.
Thank you. I have no humor anymore. It's all
no
gone
humor.
Now. Yeah, no,
okay.
It's done.
So I'm viewers, glad I wrote that book. There'll be no humor in this presentation.
Completely humorless.
Deadly serious. And it's a deadly serious subject, how to write and publish a book. I actually want to start with your dedication, which I really liked. And I almost didn't notice it. I almost paged right by it. But
that happens with the dedications.
Yeah, exactly. That's lesson one. Yeah. For the dreamers who sat down to tell a story that no one asked them to write. And I love it because of the no one asked them to write part. Because writing a book, it just speaks to that huge, crazy leap of faith a writer takes, especially when you're writing a novel, because you don't have a contract. You're writing it on spec, and you're perhaps spending years writing this thing that you don't know that it's ever going to see the light of day. You don't know if it's a good idea. So you're just like, it's a grand experiment or test. And it's so challenging to figure out how to write it and how to publish it. And as I read your book, I just consistently wanted to go back in time, or wanted to take the book back in time so that I had it when I first decided to be a writer. So you're late on the book, at least for me, but I want to hear more about the reason you wrote it, because you'd already published several books of your own. And I assume this book might've been born from a personal experience with publishing.
Definitely. And thank you for finding the dedication. It does mean a lot to me. I mean, the funny thing about being a professional writer, let's say, or a published author, is that you spend a certain amount of your career hoping, most of us hope for the same thing, right? Which is a book deal. But then when you get it, your relationship to your own writing changes. If you're lucky, again, this is the dream scenario, is that you're lucky enough that your own writing becomes monetized. The goal, ultimately, I think for a lot of writers is that we live by writing, we support ourselves with our writing. But that reality, which again, is a dream for a lot of people and very hard to achieve, is actually the complete opposite of where most of us come from in the beginning. We're not getting paid for our writing. It's like a secret life that we have. It's a almost like an affair. And for most of us, again, unless we're writing in the confines of an MFA program or something like that, we might not have a lot of support. We might have the opposite of support. We might have, we might be living at home still with parents who think this is an absolute waste of time. We might have roommates or partners or spouses who think this is the most indulgent, foolish thing. We might have friends saying, "Have you finished your damn book yet?" And the only crazy person thinking that we should still keep going, even though we're not getting paid for this enormous undertaking, which by the way, could take 10 years, right? Is ourselves. But then it happens. You get an agent, you get an editor, your book comes out, it does well, it doesn't do well. I mean, one of the reasons I named my newsletter Get Published, Stay Published is because we have a focus in America, I think, we have a debut obsession, but you want to publish more than one book, right? Probably. But how do you write another book when you already have one out and it went well, didn't go well? Where do you find that fortitude? And, you know, I think you have to find it by going back inside to the place where no one cared what you were writing, and write like no one cares, even if you're under contract. And that's really hard to do, but in order to make it in this industry, you have to do it. So that's why that dedication is there to the people trying to do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is a comprehensive book, Courtney, and one thing I loved about it was the number of voices you included in it. And I read that you interviewed nearly 200 people. And so it was nice to read tips from some of my favorite authors and people. Did anyone tell you any stories that shook up your understanding of publishing or surprised you?
I mean, I think the thing that shook me up was how generous people were with their time. I mean, one thing I was worried about when I decided to make it a reported book and invite people to, you know, join me in conversation, was that people wouldn't give me the time. You know, like Tony Doerr, what's he going to drop everything to speak to me? But he did. People were so, in fact, it was the more famous these people were and the more, you know, international success they'd had, the quicker they emailed me back. It was really amazing. People, so it was just incredible to hear from not just writers, but agents and film scouts and all sorts of, a whole panoply of people, how ready they were for such a book, you know? And I thought that it was going to take years off of my life to get in touch with some of these people. And honestly, without exception, it was just delightful.
I enjoyed the way that you play with writing maxims in the book. You start by saying it's a common misperception that writers write. What a quaint idea. Writers don't write.
Especially now. Are you kidding me? Writers homeschool their toddler. Whoa.
Yeah, exactly. Writers have their kids intruding their writing process more than ever. Yeah. So tell us more about fighting for time to write, especially now you have a 6-year-old, and how authors, you know, I think are doing it.
Ooh, are people doing it? I don't know. I mean, that's a tough question, honestly, because it is hard for me to see my writer friends who, listen, we are all struggling in different ways for sure. And I'm not saying that parents have it harder, but I never signed up for the homeschooling thing. You know, this is not like, I mean, when you get married, you go into a contract, sickness and health, if you choose to get married, but nowhere did I sign something on my daughter's birth certificate that said I have the, you know, patience and frame of mind to homeschool. No. So I don't know how people are making time. Nor do I think, you know, it would be appropriate to tell people how to make time, because our listeners are going to be coming from such different places. Some people have lost family members. They've lost jobs. They don't have children. Maybe they were about to start having children and they can't. There's so many different permutations. I think what is on the mind of creators right now is sort of, I find myself definitely thinking like there's a fork in the road, and either I'm going to pick up writing opportunities or create writing opportunities where I can get paid just so I can make up for lost income, or I'm going to write cathartically. You know, it doesn't seem to me necessarily that it's easy to do both right now. I think we all hope that the thing that we're pouring our heart and soul to will make money, but I bet that there's a lot of authors who are a little bit like me right now, where there's some things I'd really love to write, but, you know, my eyes are open enough to the way the market is right now that I have to kind of mold myself to the market a little bit and think like a copywriter. I don't know. That's my survival plan over the next year. But we'll see. You know, you had touched upon the maxims that we hear as writers. You know, you must write every day or you're not a writer, or you need to carry around a journal, or all these things. And I think you can't just do what you need to do. Think about your writing every day. That'd be nice. Think about it. Think about, you know, I don't know, the conflict or a way that you can have some plot, you know, but do you need to be at your desk writing every day? No, no one's going to get through COVID if writers think that every single day they need to be writing.
One of the questions I'm asked often is, how do you know when your book is done? And you quote novelist Rebecca Mackay, who gives a somewhat counterintuitive advice. She says, if you're 100% happy with your manuscript, it's probably a sign that it's bad. Why is total contentment a sign that it's not done? And how do you know when something's ready to send out?
So I think that total contentment is a sign that your manuscript is whatever it is. It could be a short story collection, a novel, isn't ready for publication, because it means that you're not ready, you know, as a human being. You're just not professional yet. You cannot survive in this industry if you go out there thinking, I'm infallible, my writing's perfect, I don't need edits, I don't need, you know, media training, whatever it is, I'm ready for fame, off we go. This is just not true. And it's not true for anyone. Even the major bestsellers, everyone has areas of weakness where we need other people's help. It could be in the form of developmental edits, copy edits. It could be public speaking. For a lot of people, it's public speaking. It could be just manners. Maybe you have terrible manners. Maybe you have awful, awful email etiquette. There's most writers need help being socialized, you know, and the publication process is part of that. So, and I work with, I have this business called the Query Doula, where I work with aspiring writers on their query letters. And I get a lot of email about, you know, I know I don't need your help because I know my query letter is perfect and my manuscript is very strong. It's been rejected by 7 people, but it's flawless. And I just want you to tell me why it's being rejected. Well, you know, because there's problems in the manuscript. So no, it's just a sign of you not being ready for professional life as a writer if you think your manuscript is flawless, because you're going to be told that it's flawed. You're going to get, you know, you get an agent, you get an editor. No one goes straight to print. There's the developmental edits process, which can be quite lengthy. So you get wooed by the editor, you decide to go with someone, and then they say, you know, once you've signed, well, here's everything wrong with the book I told you I love so much. You need to be ready to hear that. So, you know, to go into that thinking that your book is perfect and then hear that, that can be a very destructive, self-destructive conversation. If you go into it thinking, I'm so proud of this, I've never worked so hard in my life, the middle drags a little bit and this character is a little two dimensional, but I think I can fix it. And then you hear that, well, then you have a partner who can work you through those things, you know?
You know, I find it interesting that once authors have an agent, they oftentimes don't know what to expect from the agent or how to work with the agent, mm-hmm. how to have that relationship. And you, in your book, you talk about you've had 3 agents, which I think also a lot of people don't mm-hmm. know, is that they think they have to stay with their one agent their whole life. And you talk about how you, your first 2 agents were more like friends.
Yeah.
And then you had this epiphany that, you know, you don't pick your dentist or your accountant according to them being friends, that you really need an agent who's, you know, doing the business things for you and other things like developing your career, as you mentioned. So I guess, like, what should an author expect from, especially a debut author, expect from that relationship with an agent? How should they be an active member of forming that relationship?
Well, I mean, I think that they should start by, before there's any relationship at all, they should kind of ask themselves what they need. I mean, to be broadly general, I think that there's 2 different kinds of agents. There's an agent that's the kind of person who says, I love your voice, this book needs work, call me in 2 years when it's done. There's that, let's call them the hands-off agent. And then there's someone like my agent who will talk through just log lines as an idea, and then, you know, she'll work with me on development sometimes. If I hand in a book, we'll go through it and do developmental edits before it even reaches an editor. She's very hands-on. I mean, I would say we speak twice a week, not just about what I'm working on, but she'll pitch me opportunities. We sound things out. There's a lot of pushback. It's a very working partnership. So in order to know what kind of agent you'd be best paired with, you need to know what kind of writer you are. And also, what kind of working personality do you have? I'm someone who, you know, I'm pretty type A, and I like, if I send an email, to know that I'll have a response in 24 hours. It's not like I'm emailing all the time, but, you know, I also like to talk on the phone a lot. So I'm well matched with my agent because she really likes to talk on the phone. Whereas my second agent was someone who just never responded to emails, mm-hmm. you know, ever. She just really didn't do email. And that was very sort of disconcerting to me. So, I mean, the problem is most of us don't know our working styles or even consider that when we're faced with the amazing opportunity of having an agent say yes, which is why most writers are not with their first agent. And that's not really an overstatement. Most writers are not with their first agent because they don't know what they need. Someone said yes to them. And so, you know, off to the races they went. You know, for the book, I spoke to people who loved their agent as an editor, loved working with them, thought they were so smart. But then when it came to negotiations, the agent would just totally cave, you know, whether it was they changed the book title to something awful, there was no money for marketing, the cover was disgusting, they wanted an author photo that was terrible, whatever, their agent would kowtow to the editor. That's a big problem. You know, if you are someone who's sort of meek and mild, you're better off having an agent who isn't, you know, who has these sort of like ball busting personality traits, because they have to talk about money. You know, and if your agent is scared of talking about money and trying to get you money, whether it's for a marketing budget or advertising, you know, whatever it is, or just reimbursing your Metro North ticket, you know, on a smaller scale.
One of my favorite sections of the book was this section where you compiled a lot of quotes from publicists and editors and agents about what makes a bad author. And if you've ever been published, you have to read all those and be like, oh, was that me? You know, I hope not. But I was wondering if you could touch a little bit or define what makes a bad author and why should you make sure you're a good author to work with?
Okay. So what makes a bad author? What makes someone difficult to work with, right? I think it's when you monopolize people's time in a frenetic way, without respecting that they're trying to work for other people at the same time. You know, I think you have to really, we touched upon this earlier, but it's like karaoke, right? Karaoke's fun when everyone gets up there and sings their song, their power song, and they sit down. Karaoke's a nightmare when there's that one drunk guy who's up every three songs singing David Bowie, you know, and you're like, buddy, take it down a notch, right? There's other people that want to sing karaoke. I think it's the same as an author. When you have the ear of your editorial team, that's your time, you know, whether it's in a group email or you actually have a meeting, try to organize your thoughts so that you're accomplishing as much as you can in the time in which you have everyone there. And that you're not sort of frenetically following up with reply alls every 30 minutes of the day. It's just asking people to take too much time. I mean, I get made fun of for this, but I love the recap. So whenever I have like a big editorial phone call or something, as much for myself as everyone else on the team, I'll send out one email with a recap, and I go way deep. Okay. I use highlighters to show what's in their court, like actions that they need to take, and then what I promised I would do. And we sort of use that as a working document, you know, and sometimes I even put in a Google Doc so we can all refer to the same thing. And I just try to, I'm not saying I'm a good author because I've made some mistakes and I've been a jerk in the past. But now I'm better, which is why I wrote this book. But I think you want to be efficient. Help your team be efficient. It's not efficient to send 17 stressed out emails a day and then send texts. Did you get this? Then you're pulling people in all different directions and they're going to be very annoyed by you, you know? And also Same thing as in the writer's workshop. When you critique someone's work, you start with positive. So let's say you're lucky and you need to approach your team the same way. Let's say that you're sent a cover that you think is just an abomination, right? Well, you don't lead with that. Thank you so much for the time that you put into designing this. Find something positive. The typography is so fresh, whatever the heck. And then dig in. If you get lucky enough to go on tour, you're not sending your publicist an email that says, this place sucks. I was supposed to get a queen bed and I have a twin. No. Why? Don't even send that email. You know, send that email if, I don't know, the bookstore you were supposed to speak at book someone else at the same time. They don't need to know about your hotel bed. I'm sure it's fine. Tell reception. Right?
This is so good. The thing is, like, it just occurs to me that the people who most need this are the least likely to read books like this, you know?
And, 100%.
And one of the pet peeves that I have from authors is the ones who send the same email to everyone on the team, but not CCing. So all doing the same work for that author. And then when you finally figured it all out,
the email etiquette thing, yeah, you have to understand reply all, you have to understand how to use it,
yes.
But you know, and also send the team nice notes, and if they drink, send them some wine. You know, even if you didn't get a book advance, you can certainly afford some wine. You can certainly afford to write a nice letter to your copy editor, the editorial assistant. You know, remember everyone, it's not just your editor and the agent in the, you know, the big triptych. Just remember everyone who's working for you, and remember that they have a life and they're not your, you know, butler.
Yes. Exactly. This is, I want you to do boot camp. We'll follow up on this. Okay. So final question for you for today, our attendees and listeners and, you know, anyone who's listening to this after the fact are writers, largely going to be writers who have a dream of writing their book and successfully publishing it. What parting words do you have for them, on their journey?
Okay. Write for yourself the first three drafts and regardless of what you're writing, and then work very, very hard to transition into the reader. At some point you're going to have to cut that umbilical cord between you and your relationship to the work and your relationship to whatever it was that spurred you to write this book. And you're going to have to learn to edit yourself as a reader. And if you can learn to edit yourself as a reader, you'll be inching yourself that much closer to getting a professional team around you of agents and editors. Ways to do that are to take time away from your projects. Actually, that's advice you don't hear very often because we're so, you know, write a certain amount of words per day, write a certain amount of words per day. Take as much time as you need away from your project that you can come back to it with fresh eyes. Where would a completely outside reader be confused? Is this in-joke doesn't need to be there, you know? And another tip is to start to sense within yourself what you're holding on to in your manuscript, your short story, simply because it took you all day to come up with a certain word, or it's just so beautifully written you can't get rid of it. And what you're holding on to because you really think it needs to be there and it advances the plot. And the stuff that's beautiful, learn to not just, you don't need to, you do need to delete it, but get comfortable with the idea that it can live somewhere else. You can cut and paste it. I used to put my deleted stuff that I thought was great and had a hard time saying goodbye to on this blog I used to have. You can print them out and save them in a file. You can use them again in a later book. It's not deleted, and you're always better off, I think, for deleting extraneous sort of gassy stuff that doesn't need to be there than you are keeping it in. So don't be afraid to delete. Take time away from your project and write for yourself this summer, because it's an awkward time to be pitching anyway.
That it is.
Great advice, Courtney. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and good luck to everyone out there, and good luck to us as well.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, everyone. This interview was part of the Bay Area Book Festival's Unbound series, and you can find the whole much longer interview online on YouTube at the official Bay Area Book Festival video channel, where you can also see Grant's pandemic beard. It's great that we memorialized it, Grant, because it is no more. Now you are all clean shaven.
I'm growing it again, actually. It's coming back.
Thank God. But we are transitioning to fall here, which means, as we said in the beginning, this is the third season coming up for us. And we're excited about it. And especially because we are so deeply still in COVID here. We are in this hard world, which sucks and is hard, in the words of my 9-year-old. But we've got your back through fall and beyond. And we will be back with the incomparable Mary Carr next week to kick off our terrible threes. So thank you all so much for being on this journey with us.